Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to your leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Associate Editorial Director with Neurology Live. In this episode, we spoke with Dr. Anne-Marie Morse, a pediatric neurologist and sleep medicine specialist at Geisinger Medical Center, who sat down with us at the annual sleep meeting to discuss the landscape of challenges that patients with narcolepsy face, as well as the influence of gut health on sleep apnea, and so much more. Let's dive in.
My name is Anne-Marie Morse. I'm the Director of Child Neurology and Pediatric Sleep Medicine at Geisinger Dentwice Children's Hospital. So this was a part of the pediatric postgraduate session on obstructive sleep apnea. And so what was great about today was that we talked a lot about how do we characterize OSA to begin with. We generally in the field are always focusing on AHI. However, what about the whole person, right? So individuals who have obstructive sleep apnea, especially our adolescents, are quite complex. They're undergoing a lot of changes. As a neurologist, I'm always thinking about those brain changes. And so this talk was really looking at how do we look at all the other factors that may be influencing the risk of developing OSA, if you have OSA, making it more severe, and then how does OSA actually impact other areas of the body? So although we tend to have a focus on cardiovascular outcomes on the adult side, in kids, we may not be thinking about all of those things. What we've learned from my talk today was that, number one, when you're looking at obstructive sleep apnea, the chronic intermittent hypoxia, as well as the sleep fragmentation, actually disrupts your gut microbiome. What's interesting about that is when you disrupt the microbiome, you make it more likely to have worsened chronic intermittent hypoxia, as well as sleep fragmentation. And so this has been an area that we're really exploring more and more. The microbiome is now related to everything. And I have to tell you, as a neurologist, when I was in training, someone first told me, yeah, the gut microbiome, this all relates. I didn't believe it. And so I've done a complete 180. And what we can see is that when you have the microbiome not in a balance, we can see that not only can it have a relationship with OSA, it can increase your likelihood for having obesity. It makes it more likely for you to be in a pro-inflammatory state, driving those factors for metabolic syndrome, leading to those worse outcomes. And so when we as a field are focusing on treating sleep apnea and saying, we pat ourselves on the back, we made the chronic intermittent hypoxia better, maybe sleep fragmentation, but we haven't looked at these other factors. We now have neglected what the actual phenotype is and what may serve as potential biomarkers for overall wellness.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, you got to take the whole patient perspective to say the least. So you talked a little bit about some of the effects and the influence of gut microbiome, which, as you mentioned, has become a little bit more researched over the last couple of years. So what have we learned more about gut microbiome and its influence on sleep disorders? Just talk a little bit about how the literature in the space has grown and also some of the work that you've done on that as well.
Sure. So in terms of researching the microbiome, this is growing across multiple fields. When you look at where it really developed, it really was five different types of evidence, mainly first starting with kind of those germ-free animals, animals who are born in a sterile environment, cesarean section. But then there was different layers of this, looking at if I introduce certain antibiotics, if I introduce certain bacteria. And what we've learned from that is that it does change the trajectory of how something develops, both neurologically as well as entire system. I find it interesting that although we're looking at obstructive sleep apnea specifically today, we can replicate this in a variety of other diseases within sleep. And so for myself, who has a focus in central disorder of hypersomnolence, what's fascinating is that there's growing literature on that in narcolepsy. Some of it came from my friend Yves Dullier, who is in France, did an incredible work in demonstrating that there is a difference in the microbiome in individuals with narcolepsy type 1 versus the general population. There's even some literature to suggest that if individuals who have narcolepsy eat more fermented foods, it actually enhances the bacteria in the gut that may help in balancing some of the symptoms that they're experiencing. again, introducing a whole body approach. And I think something that patients really want to hear about, they want to know that there's things that they can do that is in their hands, in their control, and not necessarily dependence on a pill or, in this state of sleep apnea, a mask.
Yeah, well, I think that speaks to where neurology in general is going. I think treating patients more holistically, incorporating nutritionists and things of that sort, obviously has a big part. And now we're starting to sort of realize that it does have a major influence on these patients. So to kind of switch gears, you also have a presentation focusing in on narcolepsy as well. And there has been some pretty substantial movement in terms of treatments options over the last couple of years for narcolepsy. There was a recent approval for narcolepsy. So besides those treatment options and the advances that we made in some of the therapeutics, what do we still have to focus in on in terms of treating patients with narcolepsy? And what are some of the still unmet needs that we still need to focus in?
Sure. So there's so many to speak on. So when you look at the landscape of the treatment options that are available, even the ones who have been recently made available, there's a very unique character to how the FDA approves these drugs. So if you have high blood pressure, or you have a specific cancer, or you have any other disease process, the drug is approved for that disease process. When you look at the medications that we have available for narcolepsy, they're approved for two specific indications: excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy. When we go take a step back and say, what are the individuals who have narcolepsy experiencing? That's not the start and stop of it. The reality is that the disease is characterized at minimum by a pentad of symptoms, which is excessive daytime sleepiness, cataplexy, sleep-related hallucinations, sleep paralysis, and disturbed nocturnal sleep. Disturbed nocturnal sleep is one that is gaining a lot of attention because the similar daytime symptoms of sleep intruding into wakefulness, we're seeing wakefulness intruding into the sleep. So the entire day is dysfunctional. This is where we are trying to see a greater degree of medications looking at that, because when we look at the current spectrum of medications, most of them are so hyper-focused on how do we give you more wakeful hours. Not necessarily good wakeful hours, good quality wakeful hours, but then those medications very frequently result in either insomnia or further disruption of sleep. And so it's a matter of really looking at the individual and saying, how can we augment your overall quality of life? This is what patients are demanding. They're asking for better days. Very frequently when I talk about this condition, one of the things I always like to reflect on is the fact that it is united by the fact that every single patient you meet will tell you that time is a critical element of my life and I can't get enough of it. And so when you look at how can I actually create more time, improving their sleep, improving those sleep-related pathologies related to the REM dysfunction is naturally going to result in a better daytime function. And so I think the field is most excited about, one, the fact that we are having leaps and bounds in terms of growth. The number of companies who are interested in it is only growing. In addition to that, the same complement is occurring in the advocacy space, where we are seeing an increasing number of organizations doubling down on how do we give the social support? How do we give the behavioral strategy? How do we give recommendations on the lifestyle changes that can make your life more manageable? When you have a rare disease, it is extraordinarily marginalizing and isolating. Having a community is empowering and may have even more of an impact than many of the drugs we prescribe.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Morse to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, Biogen and Denali have jointly announced that they are discontinuing a portion of the clinical development program for BIIB122, an investigational small molecule inhibitor of LRRK2, in development for the treatment of Parkinson's disease. As a result of this decision, the Phase 3 Lighthouse study, which was initiated in September 2022, will be terminated. Those patients with PD related to LRRK2 mutations who were enrolled in the now discontinued program will be offered an opportunity to join the ongoing Phase 2B LUMA study, which began in May 2022. Next, FibroGen has reported that its Phase 3 LELANTOS-1 clinical trial, which examined the effects of pamrevlumab in non-ambulatory patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, has failed to meet its primary endpoint. Although safe and generally well-tolerated, the combination treatment with the investigational antibody plus corticosteroids failed to demonstrate meaningful improvements on the Performance of Upper Limb 2.0 score compared with baseline. Those data are still expected to be shared at an upcoming medical meeting. Next, according to a recent announcement from Anavex Life Sciences, all participants have been dosed in the placebo-controlled Phase 2-3 Excellence study, which is assessing blarcamesine, a small molecule activator of Sigmar-1 in pediatric patients with Rett syndrome. The trial features 92 individuals, and after discussions with FDA, it will use the Rett Syndrome Behavior Questionnaire Total Score and the Clinical Impression Improvement Scale as its co-primary endpoints. Top-line data from that trial are expected to be reported in the second half of this year. Next, PepGen has announced that the FDA has placed a clinical hold on its investigational new drug application for its Phase 1 study assessing PGN-EDODM1 in individuals with myotonic dystrophy type 1. The agency plans to provide an official clinical hold letter to the company stating the reasons for its decision within the next 30 days. PGN-EDODM1 is an antisense oligonucleotide that's designed to deliver a small molecule that binds to the CUG repeats and corrects defects in RNA processing in order to restore production of DMPK, the gene responsible for DM1, and to allow the muscles to regain proper function. Next, the FDA's Peripheral and Central Drugs Advisory Committee has voted unanimously that the current data on lecanemab, also known as Leqembi from manufacturer Eisai, an anti-amyloid therapy for Alzheimer's disease, is sufficient enough to warrant traditional approval by the agency. The therapy has already been conditionally approved under the accelerated approval pathway and has a PDUFA date of July 6, 2023 for traditional approval. In voting on whether the results of the confirmatory Clarity AD trial verified the clinical benefit of lecanemab for the treatment of AD, the panel voted 6-0 with no abstentions in favor of the agent. And finally, in line with recommendations from an independent data and safety monitoring board review, AstraZeneca has stopped its Phase 4 post-marketing study of adexanet alpha, also known as Andexa, in patients on oral inhibitors of activated coagulation factor 10A. The decision was based on the achievement of pre-specified criteria of superior homeostatic efficacy for the therapy, which was approved under the accelerated approval pathway. As a result, AstraZeneca stated its intentions to proceed with regulatory filings in both the United States and the European Union to convert the therapy to a full traditional label approval. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Morse.
So you talked a little bit about disrupted nighttime sleep briefly for a second. So can you talk a little bit about the impacts of disrupted nighttime sleep on specifically medication selection and patient preference as well?
Sure. So when you're talking about disrupted nighttime sleep, one of the first things that I think is important is that the field does not have a unified agreement of what the definition of the condition is. And so there are several things that are important to think about when you're talking about this disrupted nighttime sleep. Number one, having the condition of narcolepsy, and more so narcolepsy type 1 than type 2, although can be present in both, you have a sleep state instability. And so Kieran Mathke has done a beautiful job of reporting on this in pediatrics, and others have published some on the adult side. Emmanuel Mignot has done a great job of using machine learning models to even be able to diagnose using a polysomnography based on this. However, there are so many other factors that feed into that disturbed nocturnal sleep. And so some will say that, is this an intrinsic disturbed nocturnal sleep versus other factors? I kind of think about it as primary and secondary. The primary disturbed nocturnal sleep is because of the sleep state instability. The secondary factors come from the nightmare disorder, the REM behavior disorder, the periodic limb movement disorder, the sleep-related hallucination. When you look at all of that, you do have to think about, how do I improve? When you are giving someone a more consolidated night of sleep without so much REM intrusion, you're going to take care of those secondary pieces. You're also going to allow them to have a better sleep state period. However, one of the things you have to be mindful of is that some of the medications may further augment that. When you're looking at a person in front of you, many of them are going to complain of the excessive daytime sleepiness. So you do have to probe and ask about what that night looks like. You also have to think through, what is it that I am going to treat that is going to help them get rid of these other things? And so I think that it becomes really important for us to continue to look at this as a metric. You can identify some of that just from when you do their sleep studies, seeing it under polysomnography. But then also, what is the patient self-reporting? Are they describing that they're waking up multiple times a night? And maybe they're not saying that. Maybe they're saying, I'm waking up, I'm eating, I'm having multiple nightmares. I'm doing X, Y, Z, you name it. And that may drive you to really wanting to select other treatments that may reduce the frequency of those.
No, well, I think it's really interesting. There's obviously some of the primary and then the secondary things that you kind of talk about. I, for one, think I always give you guys so much props because to me, it's always confusing how there are so many secondary symptoms and things of that sort that may look like one, but also kind of look like the other. And it's kind of tough to figure out what is which and how you're sort of going to treat for those things.
Yeah.
So it's difficult, but obviously you guys are experts at that. So Dr. Morris, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day. The last question that I have for you is sort of just an overall thought. Obviously, this is the first day of sleep, but what are some of the emerging concepts and ideas in the sleep disorder / neurospace that excite you the most and, you know, should have some relevancy over the next coming years?
Sure. So for me, I think one of the things that are most exciting let me take a step back. There's several things that are really exciting. First and foremost is really starting to think about sleep as a tool for overall wellness. And so as opposed to how we typically are thinking of it separate from the rest of the person, really thinking about how is it an integrated model that is going to actually serve as a factor to optimizing overall wellness and also combating disease. So if you have a neurologic disorder, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, it's not by accident, it's by design that you also are very, very highly likely to have a sleep disorder. Utilizing that in combination is going to only help you augment your outcomes, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, you name it. And we're seeing more and more growth in that trajectory, not only within neurology, but in other disease spaces. The advancements that are being made to make that more practical include changes in billing coding that allow us to start incorporating things like remote therapeutic monitoring, remote patient monitoring, asynchronous means of empowering an individual on their medical journey to do more data collection so that they can actually have more understanding of what they're experiencing and have more effective communication with their provider so that their outcomes are better. This is going to result in not only the immediate, but also the predictive analytics that are going to allow us to really make those transformational changes for patients in the healthcare industry that is really much needed.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, you can visit neurologylive.com.